Session number 3176, reel 1. Sir John Slessor, reel 1.
But you can't, you know, it's quite impossible to talk about the beginnings of air power without talking about Trenchard. And I think it's quite extraordinary how he foresaw what the effect of air power could be, because it didn't, let's face it, it didn't really materialize until years later. I mean, after all, before the Second War, you see, his great idea was that the air offensive was going to be the great thing in future war. Well, ultimately, it was. I mean, there's no getting away from it. I mean, by 1940, well, anyway, 43. But not to overstate it, by 44, it was the crucial thing. And how the old boy ever foresaw the way he did, I mean, he never wavered from that, that it was ultimately it was going to be the decisive factor. And it was, ultimately, but not till 1944.
There was a time, though, in 1918 when he was a bit doubtful about the distraction that an independent bomber force would represent. This is towards the end of the First World War. The distraction it would represent from the main battle.
Oh, so he was, mind you, I mean, I think the important thing to remember about Earl Boom was that he was very much opposed to so-called dependent air power. You see, he was a tremendously loyal servant of Douglas Haig, and he felt that the main job of the Air Force at that time should be to collaborate with the Army in winning that war. Well, that war wasn't an independent air war, never could have been, because we simply hadn't got the material. And he was, bless his old heart, honey, he was a tremendously loyal parent. He was very much against the independent air force. He hated the idea of an independent air force. He said he didn't say no such thing as independent. He hated the word. If he could only have foreseen what the air was going to do by 1944, my God, he'd have...
Do you think when he's actually taking command of the independent air force for a short time, do you think that was an influential thing on him, or were the ideas for independent action by an Air Force? Do you think those ideas were already in his head? It was just that...
They were in his head, but he... I think I'm right in saying that he thought that... in fact, I think he was convinced that the job of the Air Force should be to win that war. Well, let's face it, we can now appreciate that the chances of so-called independent air action winning that war, it's not on. We hadn't got the material, we hadn't got the bombers, we hadn't got the technique, we'd got no radar, we got no nothing. His view was that we ought to use the air to win that war. And that war was a ground war.
Did he approve of the course that the air war took in the Second World War? In your conversations with him, did he have any criticism?
Oh, I think he did, but I think, like the rest of us, he didn't realise. In fact, I'm sure he didn't realise, because we none of us realised that we were perfectly right in thinking, Puggy, I'm sorry.
Yes, you were saying about Trenchard.
Well, that he was quite convinced that the air would have a crucially important role to play in winning. And mind you, it did. It was by no means negligible. At the end of the First War. But I think he was far more far-seeing than most of us were as to what it could ultimately become. And mind you, it didn't ultimately become that until, 1943-44. Because we simply had not got the weapons. We hadn't got the aircraft, we hadn't got all the technical whatnot. Ultimately, of course, we've only got to look at what happened. I wonder if I can find it. I think it's in this.
What are your own most vivid recollections of working with Trenchard when you were actually in the plans department in the late 20s? What were the main problems of working with him?
Well, of course, we were mainly concerned in defending the existence of an independent Air Force, which I always disliked the word, against the attacks of particularly the Navy. If it hadn't been for Bowdoin, we should have lost that battle. No doubt about it. But looking back on it, it's quite extraordinary to think how we exaggerated in our own minds what the air could do with the weapons it then had, which were ridiculous. I mean, Blenheims, Whitleys, those sort of things, and they simply weren't on. And we had none of the modern. I mean, we didn't have oboe or, you know, any of the modern techniques of enabling us to hit our targets. And of course, there's no doubt the air staff, I think, up to a point, up to, in fact, to an advanced point, were to blame for. We had this idea in our minds, which ultimately turned out to be perfectly right. But we didn't realize, we simply had not got the material to turn them into action. I mean, and it wasn't until, after Munich, Scheme M, that we at last gave the fighter the priority it should have had. And the result was that, thank God, Scheme M produced the fighter command that enabled old Stuffy to win the Battle of Britain.
What sort of person was Trenchard to work with, though?
Quite unique. I mean, you can't. I mean, he was. You can't really. He was an extraordinary creature. Amazing man.
You had to prepare papers for him, did you?
Oh, yes. I mean, you never could satisfy him. I mean, he produced. See, he was almost unintelligible, the old boy. He'd send for you and he'd talk away.
Had you grasped, when you left his office, had you been able to understand what he'd been saying to you?
Well, you go and produce the paper that he'd told you to produce, and you bring it back next morning, by that evening, you'd be sent for, and you'd be told, this is a very bad paper, you haven't understood me at all. And there it would be, covered with Lady Trenchard's writing, because his writing was illegible. And he'd say, now go away and produce another one. And off you go and produce another one. And eventually you got the right answer, or more or less the right answer. The really wonderful chap in his office was a warrant officer, whose name I can't remember, who was a warrant officer clerk, who was his, what do you call it,
sort of amanuense, his...
Who was his...
Stenographer.
Yeah. And somehow or other, he would get down, he was marvellous, he'd get down on paper, something which is more or less legible. But the old boy was by any means a clear thinker, and he'd talk away. But he had the right ideas, and I remember very well one occasion when. What's her name? It was a little man who was colonial secretary in the Labour government at the time. What's his name? And this was apropos of Palestine, where there were troubles going on. And this little man used to come and see the CAS. And he, somehow or other, I always remember him, he was he realized what a big man he was. He didn't really understand anything going on, but he... can't remember. But no, Earl Broome was not a great. He was not a very clear talker.
You spent quite a lot of your first period in the plans department working on his, what they call his last will and testament.
Last will and testament. Well, you see, the last will and testament was one of the few great mistakes that the old boy made. It started by being a sort of exposition of how he thought the Air Force ought to develop. And how the place it ought to take in the service setup of the day, and of course substitution of air power for other arms was a very prominent thing. But to begin with, Richard Peck and I. He called us his English merchants. And we thought that this was, and it did originally start as being something that he was going to leave to Jack Salmon, as how he thought the Air Force ought to develop. And as such, I think it would have been very valuable. And I hadn't the least doubt that if it hadn't been for the Second War, well, you know, that things would have developed in that way. But then he couldn't resist producing it as a cabinet paper. And that was a fatal mistake. Richard Peck and I were both of us violently against it. Because we said, here you are, your warning, your potential enemy, so to speak, exactly what you're thinking, you're giving them the warning of what they've got to expect. And for goodness sake, leave it. And mind you, his successor, Jack Salmon, didn't, he was worried to death by it. But the old man was insistent.
Which other personalities stand out for you from the 1920s and 30s as the most important ones in the development of the RAF in between the wars? You mentioned Freeman to me last time.
Well, now, there was the... I think myself that Wilfred Freeman was the greatest Air Force officer that there ever was. I mean, he was marvellous. But, of course, he was... mind you, Jack Salmon was a very, very fine man, very good... CAS. But Wilfred Freeman was, he could see things better than anybody I ever knew, I think. He was a marvellous man. And eventually, of course, he was, before he was VCAS, he was director of Director General, whatever they called it, of research and development, and I think it was that. But, I mean, it was he, for instance, who, on his own responsibility, went ahead with the four-engine bombers. And he was, I think, personally, and I don't mind saying so in public, I think Wilfred Freeman was a greater man than Portal. But he was his vice, and he was brilliant. And not only brilliant, but incredibly nice. And eventually, of course, when he retired, he was taken up by the aircraft industry in the biggest possible way. And I think Wilfred Freeman was probably the greatest Air Force officer between the wars. Jack Salmon was very good. Newall was very good, you know. A very underrated man. I remember an independent opinion from a great friend of mine who was in a position to know, who was Ian Jacob. And I remember him saying to me, you know, I think Newall is a very underrated chap. He was. He was very underrated.
How did you get on with Portal?
Oh, I got on with him all right. He was an odd bird, you know. I'd known him for donkey's years. In fact, we were in adjacent squadrons in France, 1917. He was in 16 squadron and I was in 5, I think. And we were quite close to each other. And I knew him then, of course, in the old days, and I knew him. And he was a most able person, immensely able person. But he was not a Wilfred Freeman, I don't think. He was curiously inhuman. I'd known him so well, and he got me back when he was CAS. And he got me in as the first assistant chief of the air staff policy under him. I was, by way of being, you know, policy-wise and that sort of thing, in a way of being almost his alter ego. But although I'd known him for God knows how many years, since 1916, he never used to talk to me properly. I mean, one of my jobs in those days as Assistant Chief of the Air Staff Policy was to produce the briefs for the Chiefs of Staff next day. And have I told you all this before?
No, carry on.
I used to go home for dinner at about 8 o'clock or something. And I'd come back to the Air Ministry at 9 o'clock and I'd collect all the various briefs that were there. And any time up to 12 or 1 in the morning, I'd take them in to Peter and say, here you are, here are the briefs for tomorrow. And we'd go through them briefly. But he was extraordinarily inhuman, and the last time I saw him, I was going to command Coastal Command, I think in October 1942, And he stopped me because he said he wanted me to go to the Casablanca, yes, the Casablanca conference with him, and which I did, and I had another 2 or 3 months with him. And at long last, I went to in to see him for the last time with the chief of staff briefs, and I was going off next day to command, Coastal Command. And incidentally, I don't want this broadcast too much. Anyway, I said to him, before I went, I said, look, Peter, I'm going to say something I know you won't like, but you don't get the best out of your staff because they're all frightened of you and you won't talk to them. And he put on that well-known Peter Portal face and said, what earth do you think you mean? And I said, well, there you are. He said, you're not frightened of me. I said, no, because I happen to have known you for 20 years. But I said, and he said, well, who? And I gave him one or two names. But that was his chap, the chap he would never... He was quite inhuman. And he had some brilliant chaps on his staff. People like Bill Elliott. Bill would never go near him if he could avoid it. Great pity.